Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 3, Part 3. That was what happened to the Pan-German movement. It did not start by recruiting its followers from the great mass of common people. It became privileged class, respectable, and restrained. This mistake gave birth to the second cause of swift decline. By the time the Pan-German movement arose, the German element's situation in Austria was already desperate. From year to year, the Parliament had strengthened its intent to slowly destroy the German people. Any hope of rescue lay in the removal of this institution. This raised a question of fundamental importance for the movement. In order to destroy the Parliament, should it be done from inside or the outside? They went in and came out beaten. They had no choice but to go in, because fighting such a power from the outside means being armed with unshakable courage and ready for infinite sacrifice. In this situation, the bull must be seized by the horns. We will take a lot of sharp blows and are often knocked down in this kind of fight. We may even have shattered limbs, but we must stand up again. Victory rests with the bold attacker only after an extreme struggle. The magnitude of the sacrifice is the only way to attract new fighters for the cause. This must continue until determination is rewarded with success. For that purpose, the children of the great masses of the people are needed. Only they would be determined and persistent enough to fight the battle to the bloody end. The Pan-German movement did not control these great crowds. There was no choice but to go into Parliament. It would be a mistake to think that their decision was the result of a long spiritual consideration. No, they never consulted any other option. Being a part of this nonsense was just the concrete result of vague ideas concerning the importance and meaning of taking part in an institution which they recognized as wrong in principle. In general, they probably hoped it would be easier to enlighten the broad masses of the people by grabbing the opportunity to speak in front of a forum of the whole nation. Also, it seemed obvious that an attack from inside the root of the evil would be more successful than an outside. They believed the screen of parliamentary immunity would add to the safety of the individual fighter, and the force of the attack would only be increased. What actually happened was quite different. The forum the Pan-German deputies spoke to had become smaller, not larger. No one can speak and reach a larger audience by using reports and summaries. The only audience they will reach is the circle which can either hear or already accepts them. The greatest direct forum of listeners is not found in the chamber of a parliament, but in great public mass meetings. Public meetings provide thousands of people who have come simply to hear what the speaker has to tell them. In the Chamber of Deputies, there are just a few hundred listeners, and most are there just to receive extra pay and not to be enlightened by the wisdom of some honorable representative of the people. It is always the same audience, and they will never learn anything new because they lack the intelligence and the desire to open their minds. Not one of these representatives will bow by choice to superior truth and then adopt it as his cause. No, nobody ever does this unless he hopes that by changing, he can save his seat for another session. These models of manhood make it their business to move over to the other party only if they suspect they could be more successful, and then only when there are noises that the previous party is not going to do well in the upcoming election. The shift usually takes place in the middle of an explosion of loudly voiced moral concerns to explain the reason for their change. Consequently, a great migration always begins when an existing party seems to be disliked so much that a crushing defeat is threatened. The parliamentary rats abandon the party's ship. This has nothing to do with superior knowledge or intentions. It is just a clairvoyant gift that warns the parliamentary rodents in time to fall into a new warm party bed. Speaking in front of such a forum is really just casting pearls before swine, and in this he references Matthew 7:6. It is really not worthwhile, and the result is nothing. The Pan-German deputies could talk until their throats were sore without effect. The press either responded with dead silence, or they distorted the speeches from the parliament floor so much that any meaning was twisted or lost. Public opinion consequently formed a very bad impression of the new movement's purposes. What the individual gentleman said made no difference, because the meaning depended on how it was written up in the newspaper. Only a small portion of their speeches were covered, and this was so disjointed, it seemed like nonsense. That is exactly the impression that was intended by the press. the only forum they really spoke to consisted of barely 500 parliamentarians, and that explains why they never reached the public. The worst part was that the Pan-German movement could only count on success if it understood from the beginning that the problem was about a new world concept and not about a new party. Nothing less could stir up the necessary inner fight to fight this gigantic battle to the end. Only the best and bravest minds were of any use as leaders. Unless they are heroes, ready to sacrifice themselves and lead the fight for a new concept, there will be no soldiers ready to follow them and die for the cause either. A man who is fighting for his own existence has nothing left over for a common cause. While the new movement may offer fame and honor among generations to come, today it can offer nothing because it is nothing. The more a movement has open posts and positions which are easy to obtain, the more people who are zeros will step forward to fill them. Finally, these political day laborers overrun a successful party so much that the honest fighter of the early days no longer recognizes the old movement, and the new arrivals strongly object to him as an intruder. And thus ends any such movement's mission. The moment the Pan-German movement sold its soul to Parliament, it naturally gained parliamentarians instead of leaders and fighters. It sank to the level of one of the ordinary political parties of the day and lost the strength to courageously fight to the death. Instead of fighting, it has learned to speak and negotiate. The new parliamentarian soon preferred and believed it was less risky to fight for the new world concept with the intellectual weapons of parliamentary eloquence rather than to throw himself into a battle whose result was uncertain, possibly risking his own life. With this mindset, nothing could be gained. Now that the party had people in Parliament, the followers outside began to hope for and expect miracles, but that, of course, never happened and never could happen. They quickly became impatient. Even what they heard from their own deputies didn't satisfy the voters. This was easy to explain, since the hostile press was careful not to give the people a truthful picture of the Pan-German deputies' work. The more the new representatives required a taste for the gentler style of revolution in Parliament, the less they were willing to return to the more dangerous work of enlightening the large masses of common people. For this reason, the mass meetings that were truly effective, directly personal, and a way of exerting influence and possibly winning over a large number of people, were abandoned. When the beer table of the meeting hall was finally exchanged for the auditorium of Parliament, and the speeches were poured into the heads of the so-called chosen, and not to the people, the Pan-German movement ceased to be a people's movement and quickly sank into a club for academic discussions. The bad impression given in the newspapers was no longer corrected by personal testimonies at meetings, and finally the word Pan-German left a very bad taste in the mouths of the common people. One thing all the champions with ink-stained fingers and fools of today should take to heart is that the great upheavals in this world have never been guided by a pen. The only job of the pen has been to explain them in theory. Since the beginning of time, the force that started the great religious and political landslides of history has been the magic power of the spoken word alone. The great masses of a people yield only to the force of speech. All great movements are people's movements. They are volcanic eruptions of human passions set off either by the cruel goddess of desperation or by the torch of the word as it is thrown to the masses. They are not the sweet words of smooth talk, literature, and heroes. Only a storm of hot passion can change the fate of a people. Passion can only be aroused by a man who feels it inside himself. Only the possessor of passion can give the words that will open the gates to a people's heart like a hammer. A man who has no passion and whose mouth is closed has not been chosen by heaven as a messenger of its will. Let writers stick to their ink pens and do theoretical work, if their intelligence and ability will let them. He has not been born or chosen to be a leader. A movement that hopes to achieve great things must be alert and keep its connection with the common people. Every question must be considered from that standpoint and decided with that view. A movement must avoid anything that might reduce or even slightly weaken its ability to influence the masses. Without the mighty force of a great people, no great ideas, however noble and exalted, can possibly be achieved. Harsh reality alone must determine the path to the goal. An unwillingness to take difficult roads in this world too often means abandoning the goal. When the Pan-German movement emphasized its activity in Parliament and not among the people, it lost the battle for the future and received a cheap, momentary success in its place. It chose the easier battle, which made it no longer worthy of the final victory. I thought through these particular questions very thoroughly in Vienna. In my effort to understand them, I saw one of the chief causes of the government of the movement's collapse, which I previously believed was destined to assume the leadership of German elements in Austria at that time. The first two mistakes, which wrecked the Pan-German movement, were very closely related. The Pan-Germans did not understand the inner driving forces of great upheavals, and they failed to understand the importance of the great masses of people. Their interest in defining the social problem was small, their attempts to capture the soul of the lower levels of the nation inadequate, and their positive attitude towards Parliament only increased their inadequacy. If they had realized the enormous power inherent in the masses as their greatest supporter, they would have approached propaganda issues differently. Their emphasis for the movement would have been put on the factory floor and the street, and not in Parliament. Even their third mistake had its origin in the fact that they did not recognize the value of the masses. The masses are set in motion like a toy car that is pointed along a path by superior intellects, and as it travels, it then maintains its momentum after it is in motion. From that point on, the founders provide encouragement and determination right up to the attack. The hard struggle in the Pan-German movement, fought against the Catholic Church, can be explained by its insufficient understanding of the people's spiritual nature. The new party's violent attack upon the center of Catholicism, Rome, also had a number of causes. When the House of Habsburg finally decided to transform Austria into a Slavic state, it resorted to whatever means were necessary to accomplish that goal. With very little conscience, this ruling house unscrupulously put religious institutions to work for the new state idea. Employment of Czech priests and their spiritual shepherds was just one of the many ways used to obtain what they wanted, the conversion of Austria to a Slavic state. The process took place something like this. In purely German church parishes, Czech pastors were installed. They, in turn, gradually began to place the interests of the Czech people above the interests of the churches, and this made them focal points in the process of removing German elements from society. The German clergy failed to counter these tactics. Not only were similar tactics completely useless in any struggle on the Germans' part, but they could not resist the attacks of the other side. By misusing religion on one hand and providing an inadequate defense on the other, German elements were slowly and consistently pushed under the rug. This is how it happened on a small scale, and things were not very different on a large scale. The anti-German efforts of the Habsburgs were not resisted as they should have been by the higher clergy, and the upholding of German interests was pushed entirely into the background. The general impression was that the Catholic clergy had committed a serious infringement on German rights. In other words, the church did not seem to feel any loyalty to the German people, but unjustly took the side of its enemies. In Schonerer's opinion, the root of the whole trouble was that the Catholic Church did not have control in Germany, and because of this, it was hostile to the interests of our nationality wherever they were found. In this, as in almost everything in Austria, cultural problems were moved almost entirely into the background. What determined the Pan-German Party's position toward the Catholic Church was more about its insufficient efforts on behalf of German rights and its constant support of Slavic interests and greed, and not so much about church's attitude towards science. Jörg Schonerer was not the kind of man who would do things halfway. He took up the struggle against the church with the conviction that this struggle alone could save the German people. The Freedom from Rome movement, also called the Away from Rome movement, he found seemed the most violent, but also the strongest way of attacking the problem, and one that surely would destroy the enemy strongholds. He believed that if it succeeded, the unhappy split between the two churches in Germany would end, and they would come together, resulting in the creation of inner strength for the empire, and this would give the German nation a huge victory. But neither the premise nor the conclusion of this struggle was correct. Without a doubt, the power of nationalist resistance from the German Catholic clergy members concerning German society was less than that of their non-German counterparts, especially their Czech colleagues. Only an ignoramus would fail to see that the German clergy never took the offensive on behalf of German interests. Anyone except a blind man was forced to admit that this was due to Germans who were in distress over the thought that the objectivity of our attitude toward our own nationality might not be objective. The Czech priest's attitude toward his people was subjective, and his attitude toward the church was objective. On the other hand, the German pastor was subjectively devoted to the church and remained objective toward his nation. This is a phenomenon that can be observed in 1,000 other cases. It is by no means exclusive to Catholicism either. This obsession with objectivity has quickly contaminated almost every one of our institutions, especially state or intellectual institutions. We only have to compare our civil servants' attitude toward a national revival with the attitude of civil servants from another nation. Would any army officers anywhere in the world put aside the interests of the government of their nation, as ours have done for the past 5 years? They are even praised for doing so. Do not both churches today take a stand in the Jewish question that is against the interests of the nation or the real needs of the religion? Consider the attitude of a Jewish rabbi toward any question, even one of quite insignificant importance concerning the Jews as a race, and compare his attitude with that of the majority of our clergy, whether Catholic or Protestant. We see the same thing whenever there is a question about maintaining an abstract idea. Governmental authority, democracy, pacifism, and international solidarity are ideas that we almost always turn into rigid, totally theoretical concepts, and we use them to judge vital national matters from the point of view they give us. This disastrous way of looking at issues from a preconceived opinion kills the ability to think subjectively about anything which objectively contradicts one's own doctrines. It eventually leads to a complete reversal of the means and the ends. People cannot tell the difference between the procedure used to reach a goal and the goal they want to achieve. People resist a national revival when it depends on the removal of a bad and destructive regime because they would say this is an offense against governmental authority. Governmental authority, in the eyes of one of these fanatics clinging to objectivity, is not a means to an end, but the end itself. And that end is sufficient to fill his whole sorry life. Such people would loudly object if anyone attempted to set up a dictatorship, even if the leader was to be Frederick the Great, who we know would be an outstanding leader. They would still object to this replacement even if the parliament was filled by a majority of politicians who were small-minded and incompetent, or maybe worse. They do this because these sticklers for abstract principles hold the law of democracy more sacred than the welfare of the nation. Some of them will defend the worst tyranny, destroying their own people in the process, because the tyranny embodies governmental authority. They will oppose even the most beneficial government if it does not fit with their idea of democracy. In the same way, our German pacifists will ignore the bloody rape of the nation, and no matter how bloodily it is carried out by the most evil military forces, they will still ignore it if the only way to avert this fate is by further resistance in force. This is a reference to the Treaty of Versailles reparations and the Ruhr area occupation by France. Resistance would violate the spirit of their peaceful society. The German International Socialist can be robbed by his comrades in each country of the world, and the socialist returns the favor with brotherly love. He would never dream of using force, or even make any effort toward defense, simply because he is a German who could never consider using force. This may be a sad fact, but before we can change anything, we must recognize the problem first. The same holds true for the weakness in the clergy, who fail to uphold German interests. It is not malicious ill will in itself, nor compelled by orders from above. What we see is the result of inadequate training in the love of German culture from childhood, along with complete subjection to the idea that we should not control our national destiny. Training that is dished out for democracy, for international socialism, for pacifism, is so rigid, exclusive, and completely subjective that it influences how we see the rest of the world. From childhood on, the attitude towards German culture has always been very objective. The pacifist, subjectively surrendering himself altogether to his idea, will, if he is a German, look for the objective justice in every serious threat to his people, and will never join and fight in the ranks of his people, not even from a pure instinct of self-preservation. We can see in the Catholic and Protestant churches how this principle has taken hold. By nature, Protestantism upholds the interest of the German culture better. This has to do with its origin and later tradition, but it fails the moment it is called upon to defend national interests which are not in the sphere of its ideals and traditions, or which, for some reason or other, may be rejected by the Church. Protestantism will always take some role in promoting German ideals as long as it concerns moral integrity or national education, or when the German spiritual being or language or spiritual freedom needs to be defended. This is only because these represent the principles on which Protestantism itself is founded. The same Protestant attitude will violently oppose every attempt to rescue the nation from the grasp of a mortal enemy. The same Protestant attitude towards the Jews is rigid and fixed in their dogma. This is also the first problem which has to be solved. Without a solution, all attempts to bring about a German resurgence or raise the nation's standing are destined to end in rubbish and will become impossible. While I was in Vienna, I had the opportunity to look into this question without having a previously formed opinion on the matter. My daily contacts with people confirmed my view 1,000 times over. In this mixture of nationalities, it was quickly proven that only a German pacifist will always try to look objectively at the interests of his own nation, while a Jew never does this with the interests of the Jewish people. Only the German socialist is international, in the sense where he considers outside interests to be equal with his own nation's interests, and this prevents him from winning justice for his own people except by whimpering and bawling to his international comrades. It is never true of the Czech or the Pole. I saw even that the spreading harm was only partly in the doctrines themselves, and our weak devotion to the nation was the result of our inadequate training in our own nationality. This disproves the first purely theoretical argument for the pan-German movement's struggle against Catholicism. We should train the German people from childhood to exclusively recognize the rights of their own nationality and not infect the children's hearts with our curse of objectivity, especially in matters of self-preservation. The result of this would be that the Catholic element in Germany, just as in Ireland, Poland, or France, will be a German first and foremost. Of course, all this assumes a radical change in the national government. Our strongest proof of this argument is in the period when our people last appeared before the judgment seat of history for a battle of life and death. As long as leadership representing the heavens was present, the people did their duty overwhelmingly. Protestant pastor and Catholic priest both contributed enormously to continuing our resistance, not only at the front, but at home. During those first years, there was really only one Holy German Empire for both camps, and everyone turned to his own heaven to sustain that future. There was one question that the pan-German movement in Austria should have asked itself. Is the preservation of German-Austrian culture possible with a Catholic faith or not? If so, the political party had no business bothering with religious and confessional matters. If not, then a religious reformation was necessary, and not a political party. Anyone who thinks he can arrive at a religious reformation by way of a political organization shows that he doesn't have the faintest idea how the growth of religious ideas or teachings build a church. Here one truly cannot serve two masters. Make no mistake, I believe the founding or destruction of a religion is a far greater matter than the founding or destruction of a state, let alone of a political party. It is not an argument to the contrary for someone to say that the attacks were only defensive measures against attacks from the other side. Down through the ages, men lacking conscience have not hesitated to make religion a tool in their political business. When they turned it into a tool, it is almost always the sole aim of such characters to use it as nothing more than a tool, and they have no true beliefs. It would be wrong to hold a religion or a church responsible for the scoundrels who abuse it. That type of person would use anything that served his purpose. Nothing could be better suited to one of these worthless parliamentary tricksters than finding a scapegoat for his political juggling. The moment religion or any sect is made responsible for his personal bad behavior, the lying scoundrel shouts to the world so they can witness how justified his behavior has been, and how he alone has been the salvation of religion and church through his eloquence. The rest of the world, as stupid as it is forgetful, usually does not recognize or remember him amid the shouting as the original source of the problem. By this time, the scoundrel has achieved his objective. These crafty foxes know perfectly well that their misdeeds have nothing to do with religion. He will hide his face and laugh so no one may see his sick joy when his honest but unskilled adversary loses the game and, someday afterward, he loses all faith in humanity and retires from the activities of public life. In other respects, it would also be unfair to make religion or even the church responsible for the misdeeds of individuals. If we compare the greatness of its visible organization with the imperfection of men in general, we will have to admit that the balance of good to bad is better in religious institutions than almost anywhere else. Without a doubt, there are some priests who see their holy office as just a stepping stone for their political ambitions. Amid the political battle, they forget that they are the guardians and not the defenders of a higher truth. But for every unworthy figure, there are 1,000 honorable shepherds of souls faithfully devoted to their mission who stand out like little islands from the swamp of the present corrupt and deceitful age. I do not and must not condemn the church if some corrupt creature wearing a priest's collar happens to commit a moral offense. I also must not condemn the whole group if one among the many soils and betrays his nationality, especially in an age when this is a daily occurrence. We should not forget that for every public traitor, like the famous Greek betrayer Ephialtes, Ephialtes, I'm going with Ephialtes. There are thousands who feel the misfortunes and have deep sympathy for their people. These great men long for the moment when heaven will once more smile on us. Ephialtes was a soldier who betrayed the Spartan army. He is said to have told the Persians about the pass. Oh yeah, okay, we're 300. The guy who sold him out. That's Ephialtes or whatever the fuck his name is. Anyway, so this reference means a traitor. If anyone feels these are not petty, everyday problems, but the questions of fundamental truth and beliefs in general, we can only answer him with another question. Do you think you are chosen by fate to proclaim this truth? Then do it. But you have the courage not to do it through a political party. This is a deception and a betrayal of your vocation. Instead, replace the bad parts with something better, something that will last and improve the conditions for future generations. If you do not have the courage, or if you are not sure about the alternative you are supporting, then let things alone. In any case, do not try to sneak into a political movement that you would not dare to reach for openly. As long as religious problems do not undermine the morals and ethics of one's own race, like an enemy of the people does, political parties have no business meddling with them. Just as religion should not identify itself with a political party mischief, political parties should not meddle in religion. If dignitaries of the church use religious institutions or even doctrines to injure their own nationality, we must never follow them or try to fight them with their own weapons. To the political leader, the religious beliefs and institutions of his people must be sacred, otherwise he has no right to be a politician. He is in danger of becoming a reformer if he has the right stuff for it. Any other attitude, particularly in Germany, would lead to catastrophe. After studying the Pan-German movement and its struggle against Rome, I came to the following belief, and that belief only became stronger through the years. The movement's failure to see the importance of the social problem cost it the capable fighting masses of the people. Its entrance into Parliament deprived it of its mighty force and infected it with all the weakness found in Parliament. Its struggle against the Catholic Church made the fight impossible in many lower and middle class groups and robbed it of many of the nation's best elements. The practical result of the Austrian culture struggle, Kulturkampf, was effectively zero. They did succeed in taking almost 100,000 members from the church, but failed to inflict any real damage. The church did not shed any tears over the lost sheep. The only losses were those who had not really belonged to the church for a long time in their hearts. There was an important difference between this new Reformation and the old Reformation. During the old Reformation, many of the church's best members left because of religious convictions. In the new Reformation, only the lukewarm left, and that was for political reasons. From the political standpoint, the result of this attempted reform was as sorry as it was ridiculous. Once again, a movement that showed promise for the political salvation of the German nation had gone to pieces because it was not conducted with the necessary ruthless clear-sightedness, and it lost itself in squabbles. One thing is true, the Pan-German movement would never have made this mistake if it had sufficiently understood the character of the broad masses. If its leaders had known that to succeed at all, for purely psychological reasons, they must never show two or more adversaries to the masses. If they do, then the fighting force is completely divided. If they had realized this, the Pan-German movement would have directed their full fighting force at one single adversary. Nothing is more dangerous for a political party than to let itself be led back and forth hither and yon between decisions because this means it can never accomplish anything visible. No matter how many things may actually be wrong with a particular religious persuasion, a political party must never, not even for an instant, lose sight of the fact that no purely political party in a similar situation has ever succeeded in a religious reformation. This is well established in history. We do not study history to forget its teachings, we study it to put those teachings to practical use. We should not think that things are different now and that its eternal truths no longer apply. On the contrary, from history we learn that we should do today. No one who cannot learn from history should imagine himself as a political leader. He is actually a shallow and usually very conceited simpleton, and all the goodwill in the world does not excuse his deficiencies. In any other age of history, the qualities of a truly great and popular leader consisted of focusing on a single adversary and not distracting the people's attention. The more unified the people's will to fight a single object, the greater the magnetic attraction a political movement will have, and the more tremendous its impact. It is part of the genius of a great leader to make even widely separated adversaries appear as if they belong to just one category. Weak characters who have difficulty making decisions will begin to doubt whether their own side is right when they see a variety of enemies. When the wavering masses see themselves fighting against too many enemies, objectivity immediately appears with the question of whether all the others were really wrong, and just one side is right. That is the first sign of one's own strength weakening. Therefore, a number of opponents must always be lumped together so that in the eyes of one's own followers, the battle is fought against one single enemy. This strengthens their faith in their own cause, and increases their bitterness against anyone who attacks it. This cost the Pan-German movement their success when they failed to realize the importance of a single front. The Pan-German goal was correct, and its will was pure, but the road it took was wrong. It was like a mountain climber who keeps his eye fixed on the peak to be scaled and takes the obvious trail while he is filled with great determination and energy. As he walks, he pays no attention to the path, and he doesn't see where it truly leads because his eye is always on the goal. He finally wanders astray. The position of its great competitor, the Christian Socialist Party, seemed to be reversed. The road it took was clever and correctly chosen. But a clear understanding of the goal was missing. In almost every matter where the Pan-German movement was lacking, the attitude of the Christian Socialist Party was right and was deliberately planned to achieve results. It realized the importance of the masses and secured at least part of them by clearly emphasizing its social aspect from the very start. By adjusting itself to win the middle and lower middle class, it obtained a following as faithful as if it was stubborn and self-sacrificing. It avoided fighting any religious institutions and secured the support of a mighty organization in the church. Consequently, it only had one truly great adversary. It recognized the value of large-scale propaganda and was skilled in working on the human instincts of the broad mass of its followers. However, it also failed to reach its dream of saving Austria. There were two shortcomings in its method: the means they employed and the lack of a clear goal. The anti-Semitism of the new movement was founded on a religious concept instead of a racial insight. The reason this mistake occurred was the same reason that caused the second error. If the Christian Socialist Party was to save Austria, the founders felt it must not take its stand on the race principle because they feared the state would collapse from the pressure. In the party leader's view, the multi-ethnic situation in Vienna made it necessary to put aside anything that divided people, and in their place emphasize anything that united the people. By that time, Vienna was already so thoroughly impregnated with foreigners, especially Czech elements, that they had to be extremely tolerant when it came to race questions. Otherwise, they could not keep these elements in a party that was not anti-German from the beginning. If Austria was to be saved, the people in Austria could not be tossed aside. An attempt was made to win the great number of Czech lower classes in Vienna by a drive against Manchester liberalism, a political, economic, and social movement originating in Manchester, England. It was presumed that this attack would be seen as a struggle against Jewry on a religious basis, which would bridge all the national differences of old Austria. Such an attack could only create a small amount of worry among the Jews. At worst, a dash of baptismal water would always save his business and Judaism both. With a superficial argument like this, they never achieved serious scientific treatment of the whole problem, and so they repelled anyone who did not understand this sort of anti-Semitism already. The attractive power of the idea was limited almost exclusively to intellectual circles. The leaders failed to go from that point to from that point to developing a real insight by using a pure emotional experience. The political elite remained hostile. The whole affair looked more and more like a mere attempt at a new conversion of the Jews, or even envy of competitors. A struggle lost the appearance of a movement born from devout conviction, and seemed to many people immoral and reprehensible. There was no reason to believe that this was a vital question for all of humanity, or that the fate of all non-Jewish people depended on it. This half-hearted attempt destroyed the value of the Christian Socialist Party's anti-Semitic attitude. It was a movement that made no pretenses to anti-Semitism, and that was worse than having no leaning towards anti-Semitism at all. The people were being lulled into a sense of security and thought that they had the enemy by the ears, while in reality they were being led around by the nose. The Jew, however, soon became so accustomed to this sort of anti-Semitism that he probably would have missed it more if it wasn't there than he was bothered by its presence. Submitting to a state of mixed nationalities demanded one great sacrifice, and the upholding of German culture demanded a greater sacrifice. The party could not be nationalistic, and if they were, they would lose the ground under their feet in Vienna. By gently evading any question of nationalism, they hoped to save the Habsburg state, and that is what ruined the movement. At the same time, the movement lost a great source of inner strength, a strength that can fill a political party with an inner driving force for the long run. The Christian Socialist movement became a party no different from any other. I followed both movements closely. One was from the urging of my own heart, and the other was because I had so much admiration for the rare man who even then seemed to be a bitter symbol of all the Austrian-German culture. When the tremendous funeral procession carried the dead mayor Lueger from the city hall out toward the Ring Street of Austria, the Ringstrasse, I was among the many hundreds of thousands who watched the tragic scene. Feelings were stirred, and I knew this man's work was in vain, because fate was inevitably leading the state toward its doom. If Dr. Karl Lueger had lived in Germany, he would have been ranked among the great minds of our people. Having lived in this impossible state was unfortunate for him and for his work. When he died, the flames in the Balkan were already greedily flickering higher every month, and fate had mercifully spared him from seeing what he still believed he could prevent. I tried to understand the reasons for the failure of one movement and the misdirection of the other. Aside from the impossibility of fortifying the state in old Austria, I came to the definite conclusion that the mistakes of the two parties were the following. The Pan-German movement was on the right track in principle as it desired the goal of a German revival, but its choice of weapons was unfortunate. It was nationalistic, but did not have the social appeal needed to conquer the masses. Its anti-Semitism, however, rested on a correct realization of the importance of the race problem and not on religious concepts. On the other hand, the attack on a particular religious persuasion was wrong. The Christian Socialist movement had vague ideas about the goal of a German Renaissance, but it made an intelligent choice in its weapons to carry out the party policy. It realized the importance of the social aspect, but was mistaken in the principles it used to fight Jewry, and did not understand the strength of the nationalistic idea. If the Christian Socialist Party had taken their shrewd knowledge of the broad masses and adequately understood the importance of the race problem as the Pan-German movement did, and had been nationalistic, or if the Pan-German movement had adopted the practical insight and attitude toward socialism of the Christian Socialist Party, along with its true insight into the goal of the Jewish question and the meaning of the nationalist idea, the result would have been that one of these movements might have successfully changed the fate of Germans. The nature of the Austrian state was the reason this did not happen. Since my convictions were not represented clearly in any political party around me, I could not make up my mind to join or fight for one of the existing organizations. Even then, I thought all the political movements were failures and incapable of carrying out a national renaissance for the German people on any large scale. My distaste for the Habsburg state continued to grow. The more attention I began to pay to questions of foreign politics, the more my conviction strengthened that this state structure could only lead to serious misfortune for German culture. More and more clearly, I saw that the fate of the German nation was being decided here in Austria as well as within the German Empire itself. This was true in cultural life and in questions of politics. Even in the field of purely cultural or artistic affairs, the Austrian state showed every sign of weakening and it was losing its importance to the German nation as a cultural resource. This was especially true in the field of architecture. Modern architecture in Austria could not be successful because after the Ringstrasse was built in Vienna, the rest of the jobs were insignificant when compared to the plans being developed in Germany. I began to lead a double life more and more. Reason and reality made me go through a bitter, though useful, apprenticeship in Austria, but my heart was elsewhere. An uneasiness came over me as I realized the emptiness of this state and that it was impossible to save it. At the same time, I felt perfectly certain that it would bring misfortune to the German people if Austria collapsed. I was convinced that the Habsburg state would balk and hinder every German who might show signs of real greatness, while at the same time it would aid and assist every non-German activity. The conspicuous mix of races in the capital of the dual monarchy, this motley collection of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Ukrainians, Serbs, and Croats, and always that infection which dissolves human society, the Jew, were all here and there and everywhere. The whole scene was repugnant to me. The gigantic city seemed to be the embodiment of mongrel depravity. The German I learned to speak in my youth was a dialect which is also spoken in Lower Bavaria. I never forgot that particular style of speech, and I could never learn the Viennese dialect. The longer I stayed in the city, the hotter my hatred burned for the promiscuous alien people who began to gnaw away at this ancient seat of German culture. The idea that this state could be preserved much longer seemed absolutely ridiculous. Austria was like an old mosaic where the cement holding the separate bits of stone together had become old and started to crumble. As long as it is not touched, the work of art still appears solid, but the moment it is shaken, it falls into a thousand fragments. The only question was when the jolt would come. Since I had never loved an Austrian monarchy, only a German Reich, the moment of the state's collapse seemed to be the beginning of the salvation for the German nation. For all these reasons, my desire grew stronger to where my secret wishes and secret love had been pulling me since early youth. I hoped some day to make a name as an architect and to work hard for the German nation on either the large scale or small scale as chosen by fate. Lastly, I wanted to enjoy the happiness of living and working in the place where the greatest desire of my heart must someday be fulfilled, the union of my beloved homeland with its common fatherland, the German Empire. Even today, many people will not be able to understand my deep desire, but I appeal especially to two groups of people. The first are all those who have been denied the happiness I have spoken of. And the second are those who enjoyed that happiness but had it torn from them by a harsh fate. I speak to all those who are separated from the mother country and must fight for even the sacred possession of their native language, those who are pursued and tormented for their faithfulness to the fatherland and who long in anguish for the moment that will bring them back to the heart of their beloved mother. I speak to all of these, and I know they will understand me. Only those who know by bitter experience what it means to be a German without the privilege of belonging to the dear fatherland can measure the deep longing, which always burns in the heart of the children who are away from the mother country. It torments its victims and denies them happiness and contentment until the doors of the paternal house open and common blood will find rest and peace in a common realm. Vienna was and has remained the hardest and most thorough school of my life. I had entered the city as a young boy, and I left it as a quiet and serious man. There I laid the foundation for a general world concept and a particular way of political thinking, which I later completed in detail. Only now can I fully appreciate the real value of those years of apprenticeship. I have addressed this period of my life at some length because it gave me my first object lessons in issues that form the basis of the party, which had tiny beginnings in just 5 years, has started to develop into a great mass movement. I do not know what my attitude would be towards Jewry, toward social democracy, or toward Marxism as a whole, and toward the social question if a cornerstone of personal views had not been laid early by the pressure of fate and by my own self-education. Even though the misfortunes of the fatherland may stimulate thousands upon thousands to think about the inner cause of the collapse, such could not lead to a thorough knowledge and deep insight that a man develops on his own, who has fought a difficult battle for many years so that he may be master of his own fate.